A very warm welcome to Midori House, live from Studio One here in London, with me, Ted Kravitz. In the next hour, we'll be taking a look at some of the stories you won't hear anywhere else. How Syria's Christian population is coming to President Bashar Assad's side, how Lyon's Light Festival is blowing away the winter blues in southeast France, and we find out why London's Design Museum has added an AK-47 and a motorway sign to its collection. All that right here in the next 60 minutes on Midori House, live on Monocle 24. But first, the latest news from around the world with Nick Kelly.
Monocle 24 News, I'm Nick Kelly. The leaders of France and Germany have agreed on a master plan for imposing budget discipline across the Eurozone, saying the EU treaty will need to be changed in the search for a sweeping solution to its debt crisis. President Nicolas Sarkozy and Chancellor Angela Merkel said their proposal included automatic penalties for governments which fail to keep their deficits under control, and an early launch of a permanent bailout fund for Eurostates in distress. Italy, the biggest Eurozone nation in trouble, offered a glimmer of hope that the bloc could halt a crisis which is threatening the common currency. Its borrowing costs tumbled after the technocrat government announced an austerity programme. The Italian Prime Minister Mario Monti said countries such as Germany and France have had their own debt problems in the past and are not untouched by their own financial problems.
I consider it very positive that now important countries like Germany and France, after having been at the forefront of the sinners, are at the forefront of the reinstatement of virtue.
Meanwhile, confidence that European leaders would come up with a credible plan to solve the Eurozone crisis have lifted global stocks, and European shares hit a five-week high today. The United Nations has expressed deep concern over the escalating violence in Afghanistan at an international conference over the country's future. The US Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, has told delegates at the meeting that the United States intends to stay the course. She also made reference to Pakistan, which has boycotted the talks in protest at a NATO attack which killed 24 of its soldiers.
The entire region has a stake in Afghanistan's future and much to lose if the country again becomes a source of terrorism and instability. And that is why we would, of course, have benefited from Pakistan's contribution to this conference.
A top International Monetary Fund official, Masood Ahmed, has said Afghanistan will need to prove to donor nations that it can effectively manage the vast sums of assistance it says it requires years into the future, even as foreign troops go home. Syria said today it would like to agree soon to an Arab League peace plan to end its eight-month crackdown on popular unrest, but rejected foreign interference and demanded the annulment of sanctions plus reinstatement in the regional bloc. The conditions were set in a letter to the League by Foreign Minister Walid al-Muallam, described by his spokesman as a positive response requiring an Arab League reply. Police and hospital sources in Baghdad say at least seven people were killed and another 13 wounded by a roadside bomb targeting Shiite pilgrims in the Iraqi capital. Ivory Coast's former president, Laurent Gbagbo, has appeared at the International Criminal Court facing charges of crimes against humanity, including murder and rape, the first former head of state to be tried by the court since its inception in 2002. Gbagbo was arrested and flown from Ivory Coast to the Netherlands last week and has since been held at a detention centre in The Hague. ICC prosecutor Luis Moreno Ocampo had this to say.
Cote d'Ivoire suffered violence for many years. Now they are changing, and I am proud the International Criminal Court will help them to define responsibilities, to understand who did what. And in this sense, will contribute to a peaceful coexistence in Cote d'Ivoire.
And several thousand people protested in central Moscow today against what they said was a fraudulent parliamentary election, shouting revolution and calling for an end to Prime Minister Vladimir Putin's rule. Vladimir Potsner, a television compere with high-level contacts to elites stretching back to Soviet times, said the losses suffered by the Prime Minister's United Russia Party in Sunday's parliamentary election reflected anger over a lack of clear vision for the future.
I think he's gotten a kind of a warning. I mean, he's been told by the population, we don't like what's going on. And I think that when the presidential elections come around in March, there's no doubt that he'll win.
Those are the top stories here on Monocle 24.
Thanks very much, Nick. Well, it's gloves and scarves weather in London here at least, and more cold weather is coming to Europe in the next few days. But for all the details, we can cross over now to our meteorologist, Thomas Schaffernacker.
The weather, in association with Kuoni Travel.
Europe and the chill is certainly in the air across the continent. By day, many major cities around plus 5 degrees with a cold wind too. Even countries as far south as Greece and Italy will be feeling the chill. Here's Tuesday's city forecast. In London, 7 degrees, sunny and a cold wind. In Zurich, 4 degrees, cloudy, some light rain. Berlin, similar, 4 degrees, cloudy with a little bit of rain. In Milan, 8 Celsius and partly cloudy. And on air travel, the jet stream is raging over the Atlantic, as it should do this time of the year. It continues to be large in extent and powerful. Some serious headwind for flights to North America. And North America, rainstorms in Texas and cities around the Mississippi, like St. Louis, snow in places too. The weather front will be losing its power, but will be also moving closer to the Atlantic seaboard over the next 48 hours. In the coming days in the US, it'll get much colder, but sunnier. Tuesday's city forecast. New York, 14 Celsius and rain. In Atlanta, 17 Celsius with rain too. Chicago, -2 and sunny. And LAX, 17 Celsius, sunshine here. Let's have a look at the Middle East now for your business travel and sunny skies across most of the Gulf, around the United Arab Emirates, Qatar and Kuwait. December normally brings a little rain, but in the coming days, it's sunshine all the way. Here's Tuesday's city forecast. Abu Dhabi and Dubai, 25 Celsius and sunny. In Doha, 21 degrees with sunshine. Kuwait City, 17 Celsius, also sunny. That's all. I'm meteorologist Thomas Schaffernacker here on Monocle 24.
Thanks very much, Thomas. Well, you're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. The time has just gone 7 minutes past the hour. In a moment, we'll be hearing from Monocle's design editor, Hugo MacDonald, on why London's Design Museum has added one of the most prolific weapons in history to its collection, the simple yet devastating AK-47. That's just in a few moments' time.
Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Monocle 24. This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
And you're listening to Midori House. Now, building a permanent collection for a design museum is the ultimate role of editor and curator. Deciding which items are to be deemed most important to human progress is no easy task. Well, London's Design Museum is moving to new premises in 2014 from its current site in Shad Thames to the previous Commonwealth Institute on Kensington High Street, and it's expanding its permanent collection. It's just announced 13 new acquisitions. The latest design classics include a Kindle and, more controversially, a Kalashnikov rifle, the design of which has barely changed in 60 years. Well, our design editor Hugo MacDonald spoke earlier with the museum's public programme manager, Michael Chavinsky, to discover a little more.
I think the one thing you've got to consider is what the Design Museum's collection has to be made up of. It's quite an interesting task because each object has to be significant. It has to be able to tell a particular story. And then those objects need to fit into clusters which sort of reinforce that storytelling. Now, the list that we've just released in terms of our new acquisitions may seem eclectic, but they all have their own particular place within the story of design over the last 120 years.
And so something like the Kalashnikov, obviously, it's a household name. It's sort of changed warfare in many ways. I mean, is that seen as a very significant piece of design, as a design object in itself, or is it more for what it represented in terms of progress?
I think every object has to be evaluated in lots of different ways. You've got to look at it in terms of its engineering, in terms of design, working with technology in order to make something function in a very particular way. And then you've got to think about how that particular example of design has had a greater influence over similar objects that have followed.
Of course. And how do you go about compiling a list like this? I mean, it sounds like a dream job to somebody like me. Is it a lot of people just sitting around the table talking about, oh, maybe we should put this in there, and then it gets shouted down, and then something else gets suggested? Or is there quite a sort of standard way of going about choosing these objects?
I think there always has to be a lot of discussion and a lot of thought to go into choosing specific items. We don't want to have a collection which has an example of absolutely everything that was ever designed within it. What we want is to have a collection of key pieces that fulfill various requirements in terms of innovative design, innovative technology, and the impact that those objects have had upon the world. So getting it right is really important, and getting it right involves a lot of discussion and a lot of debate.
And how much do you try and tailor, say, the permanent collection of the British Design Museum? How would that differ from, say, the permanent collection at MoMA in New York?
I think every museum has its own agenda, and as a cultural and learning institution, we've got to decide what our collection has to communicate. I can't comment on MoMA, but I know that from our point of view, we want to have a series of objects which demonstrate various different examples of good design, and that how we define that is sort of, you know, is something that we've had to come up with. You know, so we're collecting according to our own ideas of what those good pieces of design are.
And I mean, like I said at the beginning, the list of 13 new acquisitions is really, it's eclectic to say the least. There's the portable cassette player, or Walkman by Sony, which is great, and it's very nice to see that that's got some recognition as a dying object, really, isn't
it? It might be a dying object, but it's certainly not a dying concept.
No.
The Sony Walkman, when released, was combining new then innovative micro technology to produce something which allowed you to carry sound with you wherever you were, which was incredibly liberating in a way, and you know, allowed you to have your own personal soundtrack to your life. Now that's something that we completely take for granted now, but at the time would have been really quite radical. So it's the Walkman is a very good example of how technology advances with innovative design produced the product which was then responsible for influencing how we lead our lives, and consequently has influenced a whole range of other products since. So the iPod,
of course,
in a way is part of that story that the Walkman initiated.
And I like the fact, actually, that looking at the other acquisitions, you sort of tell the story of portable music. It's not just the Walkman, but then there's also the Discman and the mini disc recorder.
Yes.
And the portable radio, I see, as well, and a Kindle. Some people might argue that maybe a Kindle is not a great example of good design.
The interesting thing about the Kindle is that it's so current. Maybe we're not in a position to sort of fully evaluate it yet. What we do know is that the Kindle is changing attitudes towards how we consume books. There's no question that it has really influenced consumer habits in terms of the buying of words. We all see Kindles all the time. People are on the bus, on the tube, reading them all the time. It has influenced, without any question, book sales, and also it's probably the first digitally oriented product that has successfully challenged the buying of physical books.
And finally, my favourite acquisition is Margaret Calvert's road signs from the motorways in the UK. And I'm thrilled to see that Margaret Calvert seems to be breaking out into the mainstream, really, in the last sort of year. It seems like everybody is suddenly giving her the credit that she deserves for having really sort of changed the landscape of graphic design in the UK. Do you notice that her appeal is getting bigger?
Well, I'd go further and to say that Margaret Calvert is one of the people who has not just changed graphic design in this country, but has changed the nature of public signage and graphic design across the world. You know, the design work that she pioneered in the early 60s is copied extensively throughout. In a way, she's one of the people who's responsible for creating a visual graphic design language that works so well it can be adopted across different languages and different cultures because it works so well.
And finally, these acquisitions are being announced because, obviously, the Design Museum is expanding its premises and moving to the Commonwealth Institute in 2014, which means that there's going to be a much bigger space available for a permanent collection to be on show. Is this, I mean, is the permanent collection going to have a very strong educational element to it?
Every object that we display within our exhibitions is there for, you know, for very specific reasons, to communicate a strong learning message. There's no question about that. What's very exciting about the new museum is that we will have a specifically designed space totally devoted to the permanent collection, and that will become one of our core galleries that will be consistent and constant, and will allow us to tell some very strong design stories, you know, whilst supported by a number of temporary exhibitions. So yeah, the permanent collection is core to our future thinking.
That was Monocle's Hugo MacDonald speaking to the Design Museum's public programme manager, Michael Chavinsky. Right, some music now, and with Jose Gonzalez on lead vocals, this is Junip and Don't Let It Pass. Familiar voice of Jose Gonzalez, lead vocalist for Junip, and that was Don't Let It Pass. It's 20 minutes past the hour here in London. You're with Monocle 24 with Midori House. Now, over the past months, the world has watched the bloody repression of Syria's uprising. In the last 9 months, the United Nations has counted 4,000 dead as a result. President Bashar Assad's regime has been given until Sunday to sign a peace deal and agree to a peace initiative or face the prospect of further sanctions. But what of Syria's 2.5 million Christian minority? Many of Syria's Christians are supporting, indeed, President Bashar al-Assad. Well, to discuss all this, I'm joined in the studio by Malika Brown, an author, journalist and former Damascus resident, who's currently writing a book about Syria's Christians. And Malika, is this accurate? What would you say is the proportion of support from Syria's Christian community?
Well, from what we know, it's the majority of Christians that supports Bashar al-Assad. And I'd say in a better the devil you know sense rather than in an active way. Many of them have been protesting in cities such as Homs, but they've been notably quiet in Damascus and Aleppo, where they mostly live.
And tell us a bit about Syria's Christians. I mean, it's, as we said, just over 2 million, 10% of the population.
That's right. And the figure fluctuates actually quite a lot because Syria's Christians are have many links to the West through either family who form part of the diaspora in Europe and in Argentina and Venezuela, etc. So they come and go quite a lot. And the other difficulty in precising the numbers is that censuses are rarely done because they're seen as politically inflammatory. Mm. I think that tells you quite a lot about Bashar al-Assad's regime. Mm. And Syrian Christians' numbers have been bolstered recently by the influx of Iraqi Christians who flooded in after the beginning of the war in 2003. And Chaldean churches have never been so full.
Hmm. And before we talk about actually why, and in fact they are supporting Assad's regime. Just tell us some of the sort of history behind it. I mean, Damascus, Aleppo, that's got some of the oldest churches in the region.
That's right. Damascus is an extremely important city for Christians as well as Muslims and Jews. But historically, of course, it's the place where Paul had his road to Damascus moment. Hmm. It's a phrase that is used an enormous amount in the English language. I'm always surprised. The city from where Paul then went to spread Christianity throughout the world. It's also the city where Cain killed Abel, and it's where the head of John the Baptist is, and And of course, St. Simeon Stylites sat on his pillar for 40 years in the north of Syria. So Damascus, people forget, was a Christian city before the Muslims invaded in 632. And I think there's a sort of slight sense that we were here first, and you mustn't forget that it was a Christian city before it was a Muslim city.
Mm. But, of course, that doesn't excuse, or indeed it doesn't explain, why they should be supporting this regime that seems to be outcast in everybody else's eyes.
Well, as I said before, I think it's a case of better the devil you know. Syria is an interesting problem, or sort of an interesting quandary, because it's a secular state ruled by a religious minority. And the Alawites, as you will probably know, are a sect of Islam, seen as by many Sunni Muslims as heretic. And even though they're secular, Bashar al-Assad has made a very big effort to, well, posit himself as a protector of minorities and to give them a few concessions that have kept them happy over the years. For example, he's built them an Aramaic school in the city of, in the town of Malula. He's let them worship freely, etc. So he has given them a very easy ride, and they haven't been persecuted. And it's understandable that they should want that to continue.
Okay, well, Malika, stay there for a moment. We're joined down by the line by Shokat Mukari, who's the Director of Interfaith Relations at World Vision International. Shokat, do you agree with that assessment, that it's better the devil you know, or you think it's more like my enemy's enemy is my friend?
Yes, there is some truth in what I've heard. I don't think that Syria is ruled by a religious minority. The regime is not a religious one. Mm. So it is basically the ideological regime, the Ba'ath Party, which is the socialist party, which is in power. So it has nothing to do with the religious conflict between the Sunni and the Alawite. It is rather about ideology.
And what's your assessment of whether the support that we're seemingly having from some of these areas of the Syrian Christian community, will that reflect badly on them, do you feel?
Well, let me say that not all Christians support the regime.
Indeed.
So we don't have any statistics. It is true that many Christians support the regime, especially the leadership. But there are a lot of Christians who are opposed to the regime. You know, one of the prominent figures is Michel Kido, who, as his name suggests, is a Christian. So it is probably true that many, perhaps even most Christians support the regime, but still there are many Christians who don't. And I've been to Syria in July and had many conversations with people, and I have realized that this is a very divisive issue among Christians.
And Shokat, you mentioned the leadership. What's the significance of that? Because Christians do hold a number of senior positions in the institutions, a lot of institutions in Syria.
Yes, I understand that the Minister of Defense, the current one, is himself a Christian. Perhaps because the regime considers that the Christians are more reliable and trustworthy than Muslims. So, you know, the leadership is always prefers the status quo to any change, because they don't want their position to be perhaps undermined by a new regime. And this is how I understand, you know, the position of the majority of the Christian leadership.
And Shokat, lastly to you, before we get one last little word with Malika, how do you feel that Christians can become
part of any solution. We've heard in the news at the top of our programme that the Arab League is pressing for a peace deal soon in the country. Can they be part of the solution in Syria, Christian?
Well, I hope so, but not by aligning themselves with the regime. And critically, I think they need to be, first of all, Christian, which means that they should not resort to any violent means to challenge the regime. Nevertheless, they need to have a prophetic voice in terms of, proposing changes to the current regime, and not just by words, but in, making practical suggestions and asking the government actually to do what they have promised, because we have heard so far many good promises, but so far we haven't seen any implementation. So we need to urge the regime to implement the promises that they have been talking about for many years, indeed for at least 11 years since the current president came to power.
Okay, Shokat Mukherjee, Director of Interfaith Relations at World Vision International, thank you very much for joining us down the line. And Malika Brown, just wanted to get a closing thought on what you heard there and your thoughts on where this goes.
I'd like to add to what the professor said about the Christians' role. The diaspora is mostly Christian, the diaspora living in Europe, etc. And I think they could have a crucial role in either bringing all these protests to a close or to a negotiating table, and certainly in the financing of a peaceful, successful transition to democracy. So I think we mustn't forget that. And I know that the Christians abroad have been aligning themselves with opposition groups. So it's not entirely a pro-regime group.
Okay, well, that's very interesting. We could talk about it for another 10 minutes. Sadly, it is 30 minutes past the hour. We have to get the headline. So Malika Brown, thank you very much for joining us. Coming up on Midori House, we'll hear how Egyptians' Muslim Brotherhood could be becoming the new force in the country's new political order. But as I say, we're a little late. It's 31 minutes past the hour. Time for the headlines with Nick Kelly.
Thanks, Ted. The leaders of France and Germany have agreed on a master plan for imposing budget discipline across the Eurozone, saying the EU treaty will need to be changed in the search for a sweeping solution to its debt crisis. The West used an Afghanistan meeting today to signal enduring support for Kabul as Allied troops go home, but economic turbulence in Europe and crises with Pakistan and Iran could stir doubts about Western resolve. Syria has said it would like to agree soon to an Arab League peace plan to end its 8-month crackdown on popular unrest, but rejected foreign interference and demanded the annulment of sanctions, plus reinstatement in the regional bloc. Egyptians voted today in runoff contest for parliamentary seats, with the Muslim Brotherhood's party trying to extend its lead over hardline Islamists and liberal parties in a political landscape redrawn by the overthrow of Hosni Mubarak. Vladimir Putin's ruling party clung to a much-reduced majority in parliament today after an election that showed growing weariness with the man who has dominated Russia for more than a decade and plans to return to the presidency next year. WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange, who's fighting extradition to Sweden, has won the right to ask Britain's Supreme Court to hear his case, prolonging his stay in Britain. Argentina is quietly reaching out to Iran, worrying key Western powers and Israel as they try to tighten Tehran's international isolation over its nuclear program. Yemen's government has agreed upon a team of officials to oversee the military after 4 days of battles threatened to wreck a deal easing President Ali Abdullah Saleh from office. Former Ivory Coast President Laurent Gbagbo appeared at the International Criminal Court today to face charges of crimes against humanity, the first former head of state expected to be tried by the court since its inception in 2002. And Slovenia has tasked the mayor of its capital city, Ljubljana, with establishing a government to stop the Eurozone members slide back into recession, and he faces potentially weeks of tough coalition talks. Those are the top stories here on Monocle 24.
Vous écoutez Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Essa é Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
And a Monocle 24 target, yeah.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Monocle 24.
добро пожаловать Monocle 24.
Esto es Monocle 24.
Afto en to Monocle 24.
Det här är Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
It's exactly 34 minutes past the hour. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. To Egypt now, and last week Egyptians went to the polls. Now official results from the country's first round of parliamentary elections show that Islamist parties have won a strong majority. The conservative Salafists have won a surprising number of seats, and the Muslim Brotherhood's Freedom and Justice Party have taken a firm lead. But who are the Brotherhood, and how should Western governments respond to these democratically elected Islamists? Well, I'm joined in the studio now by Majid Nawaz, co-founder and chairman of the Quilliam Foundation. Good afternoon, Majid. How much of a surprise have the results of the first round of the election been to you, if at all?
Not a surprise at all, no. And I think it wouldn't be a surprise to anyone who was following the events. Everyone was pretty much expecting the Brotherhood to take the at least the plurality of seats in the parliament. And from before the Arab uprisings, I think the general expectation was that there is a trade-off between secular dictators or despots who are ruling the Middle East and the potential of Muslim Brotherhood-type groups taking over in the wake of their removal. And I think that was a trade-off that all analysts needed to consider carefully and weigh up.
So tell us about the Freedom and Justice Party and the Muslim Brotherhood.
The Muslim Brotherhood as an organisation is not, intellectually it's not monolithic. Their members don't all share their same conception of what an Islamic State is. Now, of course, their aim is to establish an Islamic State. As a slogan, they say Islam is the solution. But nobody really, when speaking to them, nobody really knows from their own leadership exactly what that means, and they don't agree on what that means. I spent 4 years in an Egyptian jail with their leadership, including the current leader. I was a political prisoner there, adopted by Amnesty International as a prisoner of conscience. And I spent 4 years discussing and debating with all of their leadership. The current leader, Mohamed Badia, was a cellmate of mine. So I'm very intimate with and familiar with their views. And basically, I think the best way to describe it is that they have schools of thought or strands of thought within the one organization. It was more like a mothership that was coordinating opposition to Hosni Mubarak than any one cohesive sort of intellectual organization.
I mean, should people see them as a radical influence, or actually is it more of a predictable move?
I think in answer to your question, should we be worried about people who attempt to impose one interpretation of Islam as state law? Yes, we should, because that's obviously not good for minorities. It's not good for human rights. The Brotherhood still have an official policy that women, for example, or non-Muslims, which comprise 20% of Egypt's population, they're Coptic Christians, their official policy is that they cannot become heads of state. So that is a worrying sign. It means that there will be discrimination in Egyptian law. However, if you're asking what can we do about it, well, it was pretty inevitable that the Brotherhood would take the plurality of votes in the Egyptian parliament. So what we must do about it is work with that situation to take the society in the direction of travel that would be closer to universal human rights. And it's important for us to remember, human rights are meant to be a universal concept. It's not okay to discriminate against Christians in Egypt, just as it's not okay to discriminate against Muslims in the UK. And if we find it objectionable that blacks or Muslims or others are discriminated against here, then we should similarly voice our concerns about such discrimination in Egypt.
It's interesting how the recent events in Tahrir Square, the Brotherhood wasn't part of that, were they? They didn't.
Yeah, so
weren't particularly interested.
I know April 6 leaders. The uprising in Tahrir Square began by young people who were essentially Democrats and liberals. And I think this demonstrates another point that we've long been pushing, and that is that the alternative to the secular dictators in the Middle East is not only the Islamists or those trying to impose one interpretation of Islam over the society. There is a third alternative, and that is the people that started this uprising. Now, your listeners may then be wondering, why is it that if the uprising began by these young liberal Democrats, why is it that they're not the ones now in power? And the answer is because they are not the most organized. You have a situation in Egypt where the most organized minority the Muslim Brotherhood, are controlling the discourse of the disorganized majority that happen to be these young, under 20 sort of liberals. And now in Egypt, for example, 50% of the population is under the age of, I say, 21, I think. And so that is the future. These young liberals and these Democrats who are prepared to sacrifice all, including being shot in the eyes by snipers in Tahrir Square for democracy, they are the future. But currently they're not organized and they're not old enough or experienced enough to form parliamentary blocs.
And is that going to affect how they're seen by the rest of European governments? Because important country, you know, Egypt, we need to get this right. We need to get the transition right.
Egypt's a crucial country. And so I think now if we're talking about pragmatically, what must the Foreign Office do to navigate our way through this and work with Egypt as a society? I mean, we mustn't do what we did with Gaza. When Hamas came to power in Gaza, there was an international blockade and it only entrenched Gaza's ideology and stance within the Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. I think what we must do is encourage the development of the reformist trends within the Muslim Brotherhood. They do exist. Those who want to take Egypt towards the Turkish model and not those who want to take Egypt towards the Iranian model.
And where do you think it will actually end up? What's your assessment?
Considering this is radio, I'll give you a soundbite. I think
we don't always want them, but I mean the next round of parliamentary elections.
Yeah,
I think in
the short term, we're in for a rough ride with Egypt. We're in for the fact that the Salafists are making it difficult because their presence and their strength, and incidentally, Mubarak encouraged the rise of Salafism in Egypt as a check against the Brotherhood. Mm. And so, again, we're witnessing what we call blowback from the Mubarak era. We're going to witness, due to the strength of the Salafists, we're going to witness people tactically voting to keep the Salafists at bay. So many liberals will vote for the Brotherhood just because they don't want the Salafists coming to power. So in the short term, we will see the Islamicization of Egyptian society. But I think in the long term, as happened with Sudan, give it one or two terms of government and people will start... The liberal Democrats with a small L, small D, will start organizing themselves and we'll start seeing Egyptian society open up.
Okay, we will watch with interest. We're out of time, but thank you very much, Majid Nawaz, co-founder and chairman of the Quilliam Foundation, for joining us here on Monocle 24. You're listening to Midori House. And now for a little music. It's And Now, funnily enough, by JJ. That was And Now by JJ. You're with Midori House on Monocle 24.
Culture with me, Robert Bound, will make you feel like you've seen, heard, watched, attended and danced to the finest and most exciting events in the world's cultural calendar.
They're like metal, glam, monster band.
They've literally just put some names of pop groups in a bag and shook it.
What is this fantastic place where all these bands still exist?
That's Culture with me, Robert Bound, available all week. Find us at monocle.com or iTunes, download our app and listen on your phone, or just stay tuned to Monocle 24. Thanks for tuning in.
This Christmas, why not give the gift of Monocle? A Monocle subscription spreads happiness and cheer throughout the year. Our special gift subscription is for only the most deserving recipients. The first issue comes hand-wrapped in Monocle design paper with an accompanying welcome letter which announces your gift and a personal message should you so wish. Subscribe now and we'll also send the new exclusive tote bag for 2011 for the first few issues. Our 12-month gift subscription costs £80 sterling, including magazine delivery costs to anywhere in the world. The recipient of your gift will receive 10 issues of the magazine and also 12 months access to all of our online content at monocle.com. So whether they've been naughty or nice, why not give them the gift of Monocle?
You're with Midori House on Monocle 24, and the culture with Robert Bound follows us in about 15 minutes' time. Now, as the year's shortest day approaches in Europe and many of us yearn for just the briefest hit of daytime sunshine in a lunch break, residents of Lyon can't wait for it to get dark this weekend. Every year, over 4 million tourists flock to the French city for the Fête des Lumières, a light festival that brings in some of the world's most innovative installation artists and technicians to transform the glow of the city. Well, light art has come a long way since the days that saw minimalist artists like Dan Flavin arranging strip bulbs arranged in white gallery spaces. Contemporary artists now use low-emission LED technology to produce site-specific work on a grand scale. Well, I'm now joined by one of the organisers of the Lyon Fête des Lumières, Jeanne Nicole. Bonsoir, Jeanne.
Hi.
So tell me, what can we expect if we get on a flight and come down to Lyon this weekend?
Okay, so the Lyon Light Festival, Fête des Lumières, as you just tell, is a festival of 4 days, 4 nights in Lyon. And so if you come the weekend, but you also can come earlier on the 8th of, from the 8th to 11th, you will be able to see more than 80 really nice installation, light installation. I'm sorry because my English is not very good, as you can see. I'm a French girl. Sorry for that.
It's so. very good and it's much better than my French. But any words you don't know, just continue in French, and we'll do a little a little translation.
So you guess, the Light Festival of Lyon is one of the most famous in the world, maybe because we've got like really a lot of different things. And whether you like to go in the downtown, in Place Bellecour, Place des Terreaux, which are one of two of the most important places in Lyon, or if you want to go to the Parc de la Tête d'Or, which is one of the biggest parks in Europe too, or if you want to go to the Theatre Célestin, the Théâtre des Célestins, or you can go to 80 places in the city, in the downtown, and even in the other places of Lyon, you will be able to see really very different things. From Naked Flame to video projections, because video projection is one of the most. It's like a show, really, on the wall. But also, you can go and see little installation, maybe a spectacular project, or maybe just something with the local associations. So there is really a lot of things to do. Tell me what you like, and I will tell you where you've got to go.
I like the sound of everything you've got there. But before I ask you how many people you're expecting, it's interesting you say that you're balancing the Naked Flame stuff, flamethrowers, stuff like that, with the artists. What kind of artists do you have? And tell me about some of your favorite artists who are doing things there.
Yes, so it's really important for us not to say we want this kind of artist. We make a very big competition, and artists from every kind of subject can come, whether it's lighting designer, architect, streetscape designers, video makers, and they can come from all over the world also if they want. And we've got an English team this year, which is Paul Cox Cage Studio, coming from London, which will be in Hôtel de Ville, so it's like the city, the house of our mayor. And so we really like to have a lot of artists, conceptual designer coming from everywhere and from every part of the city and of the world. So... And that it.
Yeah, and tell us about some of the numbers. How many people are you expecting?
How many people? It's hard to say because, as you can imagine, it's quite hard for us to count every people coming. But it's like 3 or 4 million people coming each year, and it's 4 days. So 4 days and 3 or 4. Million people coming, and they can come for 1 or 2 or 3 nights. They can come from Lyon, of course, because it's a traditional festival, but also they can come from France, Paris, more and more, and it's also very, very known in abroad. So we also have got a lot of international population, and we hope to have 3 or 4 million people. And to tell you the truth, we hope to have people coming from from abroad and from the rest of France and from Lyon, but we hope that everybody will be happy to come, and part of the time there is so much people that we hope everybody will be really very happy to come.
And I understand some of your associates have advised other authorities. I mean, I'm looking, I know there are some people from Kobe in Japan who have a luminaire themselves. They're coming to Lyon, but you advise other cities?
We've got the London project. We also have got the project you are talking about is from Japan. It's like a big ceremonial traditional walk in the city. We also have got, let me see, I'm not sure, people coming from... I'm not really sure. Not to tell you some.
I have other other places. I'm wondering if there's anybody from Blackpool, which is a country in it's not a town in the north of England, famous for its illuminations. I think they could learn quite a lot from you, actually.
Okay.
They could learn a lot.
I'm sorry. I thought you were speaking of conceptors. Yes. Of course, we've got like. It's like 40 delegations coming from abroad, and they come, and we have a special meeting for them with professionals from every part of world too, and we know that it's really very nice for city from abroad to come and to see what we can do in the city like Lyon, and then they might do the same thing in their city.
Okay, brilliant. Jeanne, Nicole, thank you very much for joining us. That's Jeanne Nicole there, one of the organisers of Lyon's Fête des Lumières. Now, there's a social revolution happening in India, and it's not on the streets or in Parliament, but rather on television screens. Soap operas are starting to feature storylines, not about joint families, but about people falling in love. Child marriage and even obesity. Monocle's Delhi correspondent R.T. Begatteri took a closer look at what's making Indian television tick.
There are a few things you might not know about Indian television. First, there are hundreds of channels, and there are more starting up every day. There are also dozens of languages. On any given day, I can tune into news in Urdu, a kids' show in Tamil, or breakfast TV from Nepal. There are music channels, religious stations showing chanting gurus all day, tele-shopping, and lots of soap operas. And there's even an entire channel dedicated to vintage cricket matches. In fact, there is so much television on in India that no one really watches the same thing anymore, according to TV columnist for the Indian Express newspaper, Shailaja Bajpai.
You still have television, is still not reached another, I think at the last figure I remember is about 300 million people. It's still not covered by television in this country. I mean, when you're talking about a billion plus population, it stands to reason that the market is much larger than anything else we'd normally think of. And given that to launch a satellite channel today is not very hard on the pocket, you will see them mushrooming up. So I think you will probably have an audience, enough of an audience to carry it through. But I think the figures, your viewership figures show that the viewership for channels is much more widespread than it used to be. We used to have a rating for an entertainment channel, the top soap opera of the day would get you about up to 15 points on a TRP. That's the viewership rating point. Today, really nothing goes beyond 5.
TV news is one area that's particularly buoyant. India has almost 250 24-hour news channels, and there's another 150 or so in the works.
I don't believe that anywhere in the world there are that many news channels, and all 24/7, and in many languages, states, local news, and I'm not even counting the local cable operators who probably run some kind of news rackets of their own. Even in terms of entertainment channels and your movie channels, the range is just stupendous now. It's in every language and multiple in every.
The problem with this much competition, however, is that with so many channels competing for eyeballs, quality will inevitably suffer. Some news channels might have started out with a serious BBC-like tone, but now they all seem to be locked in a competition as to which announcer can shout the loudest.
On the programme this evening, a look at what else, the war over FDI in retail, with the government pulling out all stops. Many are calling it Prime Minister Manmohan Singh's nuclear deal moment, part two. How far?
I think what you've noticed over the last 3-4 years certainly is the level of shrillness that has increased. So that in order to cut through the competition, you need to be heard. So when I'm switching a channel and going to another one, you normally would stop automatically at the one making the most noise. So there's a lot of noise out there, especially in the evenings if you listen to the discussions. It's just raising. The decibel level has just been rising.
Television entertainment is a whole other story. Hindi channels abound with soap operas. These used to revolve around the home and family and were known as Sas Bahu serials. Sas means mother-in-law, Bahu is daughter-in-law. Clearly, many had storylines revolving around this particular, often fraught, dynamic. But political change last decade brought a renewed focus on the poorer sections of India, and this has seen a change of TV fodder.
It reflects a kind of political change in the country, in the sense that you had a UPA government that came in 2004, whose whole focus was more on what they call the Aam Aadmi or the common man, and with the focus more on rural employment schemes, generating more economic wealth for people, the underprivileged. You saw the shift in focus, even in TV serials, to more social, what we'd call more socially relevant themes. Therefore, you had a very popular serial on Colour of Your Skin, which has been, you know, is one of those disastrous Indian hang-ups on being a fair. You have you had a very popular serial called Balika Vadhu, which was about child marriage. You had another one which was quite popular on female feticide. So some of these were within the format of a Sas Bahu, but were actually about other subjects. So there was a shift, and I think that has continued. Now, of course, given the demographics of India and this over 60% of your population being under 35 years of age, you see that it's about younger people in the family, not necessarily married or just newly married young couples, either falling in love, forming a relationship. So the theme of love has romantic love, right? Which was never there in the original Sas Bahus, which was all about the joint Hindu family and husbands and wives and all of them coming together and living under one house and trying to manage.
That's Monocle's Delhi correspondent Aarti Betagheri reporting. Well, that's it for this edition of Midori House. Today's show was produced by Sophie Grove, researched by Hannah Jenkins. Tune in for the Monocle Daily tonight at 2200 GMT. But from me, Ted Kravitz, from Midori House here on Monocle 24, it's goodbye.